Hello, Will.
Morning, Ryan. How are you?
Very well, as always.
Fantastic. Pretty good. Bit sleepy, but pretty good. obviously, today we're talking a bit about getting offers. So neither of us are probably feeling as good as some people have been this month when they've had those congratulatory letters, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
This is definitely thrilling. But equally, I'm sure there's a few people out there who are a little bit disappointed round about now. I guess all good things come with bad things as well.
Yeah, and I think the few people is probably the majority, unfortunately. Just because of the way, you know, the Oxbridge admissions in particular work. So we're going to be talking a lot about Oxford and Cambridge and our experiences of kind of, I suppose a good place to start would be after we walked out of our interview room, what we expected, and then all the way up till we actually
I like that.
So, I mean, I can remember my interviews fairly well. And I remember a little bit of the aftermath of Cambridge once I'd had my interviews. Okay. What are your experiences like? Do you remember them clearly or are they a blur?
So I had two interviews. I had one at the college I'd chosen, Christchurch, and one at Wadham. Mm-hmm. And I remember coming out of the Christchurch interview and feeling like that went quite well, and coming out of the Wadham interview knowing that it hadn't gone very well.
Okay.
And, you know, I discussed it a bit with the other people that were there as well, but I was mindful that I didn't want to over discuss it with them because it's too easy to over interpret how they thought their interviews went and how you thought your interviews went. So I talked about it with them a little bit, but I didn't overthink it. Yeah. But my approach was, I think I was a little bit pessimistic. I wasn't overly hopeful, but I thought if I do get in, it's going to be at Christchurch. There's no way that I'm going to get into Wadham because that interview just was so, I just could kind of tell that they weren't enjoying the interview as much as the ones at Christchurch seemed to be.
Yeah.
So obviously I would, you know, we weren't quite gelling in the same way.
And when was your interview? Was it kind of the first half of December or?
It would have been early December. I can't even remember if I missed school for it. I might have missed a bit of school for it because it was quite early. That was back when we were at the college. So I'd stayed over, I got there the night before, had the interviews that day, and then stuck around another night and morning, and had to wait until I think sort of 2 p.m. the next day. And so that was quite stressful, actually. I was quite worried. I don't think I was worried, but I was aware that I could be asked back for another interview. And then, of course, that's another whole thing that you have to go through. So there was a bit of that evening we sort of all had dinner together and talked about it. And there was very much another interview might help balance out what happened with Wadham, but equally it's, you know, another stressful experience to put yourself through.
Mm.
But yeah, I guess, so you had one interview?
I got a real grilling. I had three.
Okay.
In the space of one day. So that was quite an interesting experience because obviously I'd gone there with a couple of, literally two friends from school. Actually, no, it's just one friend. And I remember meeting up with her at the end of all of our interviews.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to know how they've gone. I think because, you know, even if you think that they've gone well, we often talk about this, don't we? That if you think an interview's gone well, it's potentially a bad sign because you weren't pushed enough. Whereas the interview that you thought didn't go as well, we didn't have the answers, may have actually gone a lot better because we were really trying to see how far you could go. So, and I was quite aware of this when I, you know, walked out of the interview rooms.
Yeah.
There was a girl who I'd met before, like in the interview waiting rooms, and she said her interview was about 6 minutes long, and she said the fact that I came out of mine. So she went in right after I did.
Yeah.
But when I came out, I looked completely exhausted. And she said, that put me off way more than anything you could have said. And I had to apologize and say that wasn't my intention.
Wow, yeah.
But you know, I remember walking out thinking, okay, they weren't disastrous. I found them quite challenging.
Yeah.
But I think it could have gone either way is kind of the way I looked upon it. So, and then not much happens, right? Like you walk out, you go home. Well, how did your family react? Because my family had loads of questions for me.
Yeah, I mean, we sort of talked about it, but I think a lot of students spend that sort of December just worrying about it, and they sort of can't get it out of their head. But I think it was kind of just I wasn't overly hopeful. I didn't think my TSA had gone very well. And in the end, it had been fine, but nothing spectacular.
I guess you didn't know your TSA going
into the end. So I had no idea. Obviously, it was good enough, but I didn't know, but I didn't feel like I'd done amazing. And then obviously, I've got this sort of mixed batch of interviews, with one feeling like it went better than the other. So I don't think there was this sort of eager waiting of, you know, I think I've got the offer. I can't wait to get that letter. I think we talked, you know, my parents were very excited, and I think both sort of living vicariously through me.
Yeah,
And yeah, I mean, my advice to whenever I speak to students now is to just sort of do the interviews and then forget about it. And so you're not worrying about it. But I kind of did that myself.
Easy to say. I don't know how easy it is to do.
It's easy to say. And I think if you think you're going to get in, it's even harder to forget about it. But if you sort of aren't so sure you'll get in, then you can kind of forget about it. And then it genuinely is a nice surprise when you get the letter. But you're right. It's very easy to say, harder to implement.
Yeah. I mean, I remember my interview, and that was, I think, on the 10th of December. 2008. Yeah. And I remember the date because my college was interviewing people over three separate days, and one of my best friends who turned out to be my best friend eventually, ended up having his interview the day before.
Okay.
And then obviously there were people, because there were 150 of us that applied, they couldn't squeeze all of us in the same day. When I went home, my parents had just had lots of questions, but I think I'm generally quite a pessimistic guy when it comes to managing expectations. So I think in my heart, I was like, okay, it could be like yes and no, 50-50. I think they chose to hear the pessimistic side of it. So I think I remember my dad was kind of psychologically preparing me for a rejection. Yeah. I don't know if you had this experience or not.
Well, so it's difficult to remember, really. I've got a very strong memory of the A-level results day. That seems to have been what stuck a lot stronger. And I guess maybe because that's where it's all, because, you know, even an offer letter is still conditional, right? Whereas, you know, oh, sorry, yeah.
No, I was just saying, did you think there was a risk that you wouldn't? I mean, for me, the biggest hurdle was definitely getting into Cambridge versus, like, you know, I was pretty sure of myself that if I got an offer, I would work and make sure I got the grades. Like, I could see a world where I didn't get into Cambridge.
Yeah.
Whereas I couldn't really see a world without, you know, obviously something going terribly wrong.
Yeah.
Where I wouldn't get 3 A's, for instance.
So, yes. So, I mean, I've been told lots of times that, you know, it's harder to get the offer than to get accepted. Right.
Yeah.
This was, though, at a time when I was really struggling with maths. So I was being through sort of the latter end of my lower sixth into the start of my upper sixth. I kept being told by the maths department to drop further maths because it wasn't going very well. And so I guess there was a little bit of uncertainty. I mean, I've been predicted 4A stars. And so I was very wary that I might not get that. And I guess obviously you don't need to get that. And I didn't get that, but I still got in. But I think I still had this worry that something could go wrong. I was worried that if I'd been predicted 4A stars and then I only got one, for example, yes, I would have made the entry requirements, but like I'd be seen as fraudulent or something like that. So that was a bit of a concern for me as well. So I guess part of me knew that the hardest bit was over, but I still had that sort of concern in the back of my mind. I think I was relatively confident I could get an A star in 2 A's. I did 4 subjects, so that helped in case one was less good.
Yeah, it's the psychology of the way it works, right? Because it's difficult, isn't it? Because if you think you can get away with 3 A's, then the psychology of, well, I can just get away with 3 A's. Should I just do that, or will that make me look lazy? Versus, I could read a lot of textbooks and kind of still get 3 A's, but be a better applicant.
Yeah,
psychology. That's an interesting. I think there's a college in Cambridge. I don't know if you know this, called Christ's. And they used to do this thing a while ago, where they would give out conditional offers of 3 E's, which is
three E's.
This was
like a really low grade.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, like E. And the idea was essentially, they can't give out unconditional offers.
Right.
Yeah, that would look terribly, but they could give out essentially an unconditional offer because with the way things worked, you had to really throw things away in order to not get any marks at all.
Yeah.
And that used to tell them, there was a rumor that they used to tell them a lot about the type of person you are and how lazy you are.
Okay.
Which would be that if you carried on and got 3 A's, A stars didn't exist back then. You got 3 A's, and actually, you would rise to the highest level, not just fall to the target you were given, essentially. Which I thought was an interesting way to do it, but it's almost like a science experiment at that point.
Well, I did have friends who were the tactic seemed to be that obviously you applied to 5 universities, and if one of those universities was sort of a less highly ranked university, their tactics seem to be, we'll offer these guys unconditional offers because some of them will just take it and sort of be less aspirational because they can be lazy. And I knew people who genuinely did do that. You know, they had, it started off being their bottom choice, and they'd applied to other good universities that they wanted to go to more. But then once they got that unconditional offer, I guess, you know, the motivation to really push yourself for that other university becomes less, and you have to be very self-motivated to still want to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to really want to go to UCL to make sure you work for the A star and 2 A's, you know, aside from if you just kind of would like to go to UCL, but you're not that bothered. So I do think whilst those universities need to do it as a tactic to sort of get stronger candidates in, I do think it generates an environment of, like you say, sort of just doing the minimum that you can and losing that push, basically.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it? So I guess coming back to topic, with December passes, obviously our families have lots of questions. You know, my parents were very, very keen to find out more, but ultimately there's only so much you can convey and so much they can kind of, unless the institutes themselves, is limited amounts. Like, and then there's a bit of a waiting game. And I think it's even longer now for students, but back then it felt like forever. I think I found out on the weekend, on my birthday weekend, actually, which is obviously a very, very nice birthday gift. But I was very worried. My parents used to like joke that, oh, we're going to have to put you on suicide watch for the next few days. But I think, you know, it just showed how much that whole thing meant to me. I was like, yep, this is it. And my dad was, I was saying, you know, we're trying to kind of psychologically prepare me for failure. Kind of say, look, it's not that great. Like, you'll be fine. Like, it's not a big deal. But I'd have to say, look, I'm not giving up hope. Like, bear with me, there may be a chance. And then the next thing I remember is being like frantically woken up by my mom saying there's a letter from Cambridge, which is funny because pretty much we didn't have like a set day when we'd find out. We was just told in the first couple of weeks of January.
Interesting. Okay.
With like an ultimate date of it will be before this day. So, and emails and things weren't as ubiquitous as they are now.
Yeah.
You know, smartphones had just come out, for instance. So I had like this morning ritual where I would wake up. First thing I'd do is like go to the like the post box where and see if like the post had fallen on the welcome mat.
Right.
If it hadn't, I'd go around the house trying to ask if the post had come.
Yeah.
If my parents were at work, I'd call them and say, look, has any post come? Did you open it? Pretty much it was about a 20-minute exercise of kind of disappointment. And then the one day I didn't do it because it was a weekend, that's when the letter came. And I was, yeah. When it arrived, I was pretty petrified. I didn't want to open it. I was really,
yeah.
I remember myself like visibly shaking a little bit. Because I was like, well, what if it's a no? And mum was like, no, open it. It's a really thick envelope. It's probably.
It must be a yes.
Yeah, it must be a yes.
That whole extra character.
And it was really annoying because this entire envelope had so many pieces of paper. So eventually, I mean,
right.
It was semi-anticlimactic because there were just so many random pieces of information in there.
Yeah.
By the time I found the actual letter which said, congratulations, you've got a place.
Yeah.
I kind of already knew I'd got a place because of all this extra paperwork, like, tell us your room preferences and dietary requirements. And
yeah, that gives it away a bit. Imagine like, if you got to the end of it and they just said, oh yeah, sorry, you haven't got a place.
Yeah, imagine if you like just missed that one letter, sent all this other information to them. So obviously, you know, that was, and my mum still got the, so she did the whole thing of videoing me opening it. So that
right.
Idea is still around somewhere. I think I was in my PJs, otherwise I'd probably put it up somewhere.
It's interesting. Now, I'm trying to remember. I think it was in an email. When
really? Oh, wow.
It's difficult. You know, it was a little while ago. I think it was in an email. Or maybe it was
later. A new generation.
Well, yeah, I think definitely on results day, it was all emails. And like it was when I was getting my results, it was kind of we were getting into the period where you didn't even need to go into school anymore to get them.
No.
You know, I still did because I thought, you know, I want to go in. But there were still lots of people who didn't bother. They just got it all electronically. And I've got a suspicion that the offer was sent by an email, which I think is less exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
You
want to be... I get it, though, because if someone's quite anxious, it's probably best that they have a very controlled environment around them when they find out.
Yeah.
I always kind of I don't know if you're probably going to tell me this was you now, but I sort of cringe when I see like students opening their GCSE or A-level results on like national television or something. Like I just think that takes a lot of bravery.
So my GCSEs, I was very surprised. I wasn't really expecting them to go as well as they did. And I ended up they having a photo taken, and they sort of the people who got straight A stars, we sort of were put in a group, had a photo taken, and that ended up in like the local paper.
Okay. But
that was quite a surreal thing because I sort of, you know, I'd turn up that morning hoping for the best, and then all of a sudden it's definitely strange. Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't want anyone recording whilst I opened a results thing. I wouldn't want that.
I was quite against it with my mum, but then she's obviously very very hard to say no to at times.
Yes.
And also she made the good point that like, if it is a rejection, I could just delete it straight away. And I was like,
yeah,
okay.
That's fair. But I guess, so because you were applying for medicine, I guess your offer is in a slightly different context to how it was for me, because by the time I had sat my Oxford interview, I'd gotten four offers from other universities already.
Wow.
So I'd applied to Birmingham, Southampton, UCL and Exeter, and I'd got all the offers from them. So, you know, conditional on the grades, I suppose. So I guess I was in the position of, you know, if Oxford doesn't work, it is, you know, I've got those to fall back on. But so by January, when you found out from Cambridge, who else had you heard back from? Who else had you had interviews with?
I'm trying to remember now. That's a good point. So UCL hadn't got back to me. I'd had an interview at King's.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to remember, I think Cambridge was my first offer.
So that's obviously, so that's going to have even more pressure on it, right? Because even though it's the hardest, the fact that it's first still carries a lot of emotional weight.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I think King's got back to me with an offer for exactly the same grade requirements, but they made me an offer as an international student, which was really bemusing, given that I basically spent 12 years in the UK, or 10 years in the UK.
Yeah.
More on that later. and then thankfully I ended up with a backup at Birmingham. So we'll, you know, if we both did get rejected at Cambridge, I'd like to think we could be friends at Birmingham.
It was my second option.
Yeah, same. So it was my backup because it gave a slightly lower grade requirement.
Ah, very tactical. Well done.
It was, yeah. As much as I wanted to go to King's with it and pay three times the fees, I chose not to.
Yeah.
I was quite charitable. I think I withdrew my UCL application as well.
Ah, okay.
Because I thought it was just no point.
You're not going to pick it, yeah.
Yeah. Let someone else have a go.
So the point in January, you'd had two interviews, but still to interview at Birmingham.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's very different for medics. It's much more drawn out, the whole thing, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, it's interesting though, because I wonder if, obviously, with if you're applying for the early deadline because of Oxbridge, universities presumably make the assumption that, you know, if you're the head of admissions at UCL or Bristol, and you get an application submitted to you before the 15th, it's a reasonable assumption to make that this person's applied to Oxbridge, right? Like it would take someone extremely organized and a very school that's pretty much ahead of its time in order to complete everyone's UCAS by the 15th of October.
Yeah. No, I think they know.
So that almost kind of, they must almost have a preference or a predilection for these early applicants.
But I guess, so you might think, well, oh, they must be Oxbridge caliber, so they must be good. But on the other hand, actually, this university is probably thinking, this guy doesn't want to go to my university.
Yeah.
Then, you know, we'll be lucky if we get to be second picked.
Although 80%, 90% of kids don't get in, so.
Well, sure.
It's a numbers games, right?
But I suppose if let's say you're UCL in your situation, it's difficult for you to know that you are the backup, right? Mm. So I think it's a bit more of a, whereas if it comes to the 15th of Jan and someone applies and you're UCL, I think you feel a bit more confident that you're first, if not first, you're second. So it would be interesting to see if they do have a unwritten policy about how to approach it. I think if you're a smaller university and you see someone who's made an application to you on the 15th of October or, you know, a couple of days before, that I anticipate you probably think, well, you know, this is a bit of a stab in the dark, but let's try and give them an offer as quickly as possible to see if that makes a difference. And maybe, again, that's where the unconditionals can come in. I think they have clamped down on unconditionals.
They have, yeah. They didn't really used to be a thing when I was applying.
Yeah.
So it just wasn't a big thing. But now, yeah, it's just definitely a much larger aspect. Yeah, so it's interesting because I was quite jealous of my friends who were non-medics who did have offers.
Yeah.
And, four is quite rare. Like, I don't remember anyone having, maybe one person having four offers by Jan. But, yeah, definitely some people have three or four, two or three.
Yeah.
And that used to make me nervous. I was like, why did I pick such a difficult course in university? But actually, it was, you know, as far as memories go, that's probably pretty up there in terms of how special it was. And of course, it was nice that it was because it essentially coincided with my 18th birthday.
Yeah.
It felt very much like the next phase of my life was about to begin.
Yeah, that is good. That is good. You're all set and ready.
My parents had ordered two cakes because obviously it was my birthday that weekend.
Okay.
And they had to like frantically cancel because it was a congratulations, you're going to be a doctor cake. And a commiserations. Congratulations, you will be a doctor one day.
Don't worry, medicine sucks.
They told me one was just a square cake. And the other one, which was the one I ended up having, was a cake shaped like a stethoscope.
Okay.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. Interesting how that would work. Was it very long?
It wasn't that long. It was quite short, stodgy.
Okay.
It was still in a square. Like they just kind of scrunched it up a little bit.
Sure.
So I you know, obviously it was a pretty positive experience. I mean, we've talked about my experience. You said it was just an email, and what was the setting? Were you at home, school?
I think I was at home. I think it was just an email. Obviously it was very, very exciting. And I think it was nice because, like I said, I was a bit pessimistic going into it. And again, I think it's better to be pessimistic and be surprised than be really optimistic and be disappointed. That was my whole ethic, was I don't want to be really, really thinking that I'm going to get it and then not. So it was, you know, very exciting. I think I still had this overhanging worry of I still have to get the grades, but it was pretty satisfying. I mean, particularly because I'd had, I remember one teacher when I mentioned that I was applying to Oxford, she was a nice teacher, but she couldn't stop herself from laughing. and so I felt quite vindicated by the offer letter. You know, that was quite nice to sort of have that.
Did you tell her?
Oh yeah. And I remember on results day when I, you know, when it was all confirmed, I saw her. I think she said something along the lines of, you know, oh, well done, I'm really happy for you. But I was thinking, you snake.
No, you're not.
But yes, so it was nice. You know, I don't think you can have a bigger ego boost than the University of Oxford or the University of Cambridge saying, you know, we want to take you on, right? If you're ever unsure of yourself, that's gonna help.
And I think that's part of the reason why students apply, right? Like, yes, there's a brand name. Yes, there's a research facility. But for me, and I'm sure for a lot of people, it's very much, look, we think we're probably in the top segment, if not the best segment right now.
Yeah.
But we want to kind of continue to challenge ourselves and see, and you know, essentially this is the biggest challenge that we can see, and therefore we want to overcome it. Right? And you know, that never ends. So you get to Cambridge or Oxford, and then actually suddenly you're in a cohort full of incredibly bright people.
Yeah.
And the top segment of them will be going for first class degree. Even the scholars compete with themselves as to who gets the highest first. There's no end to into these things, right?
Yeah, and it's definitely, you know, what way can you prove it more than getting involved in this obscenely competitive process and doing well out the end of it? Yeah, but it was good. You know, after that, I was pretty happy. 5 offers. It's sort of. It's weird though, because when something like that happens so early in that school year, because it is really early, right? You've only just started year 13, really. You're a term in.
Yeah.
It sort of makes you sort of think, well, I'm kind of just ready to go and do it now. But instead, I've got another 6 months of school and exams to do instead.
Yeah.
So it is, that was,
yeah, I'll just do it now.
Yeah. So come on, I've got the offer, here I am. Let's go.
Hello, Mr. Christchurch, I'm ready to begin.
I wasn't particularly close friends with most of the other people applying to Oxford and Cambridge. So
that's going to be my next question, is how, obviously it's great that we've got in, but how did we deal with our friends and colleagues who didn't get in, potentially?
Yeah, so I was going to say, none of my close friends applied. One of my close friends did apply the following year, actually. He was the kind of person who sort of didn't really gel with school at GCSE, but then sort of hit his stride in A-level, and so applied with the A-levels in hand rather than predicted grades in GCSEs. I think, you know, the school wouldn't predict him the grades that he deserve to be predicted as well. So he applied the following year and got an interview and got a rejection. And so that was obviously pretty sad, because I was very excited for him to join in. I think he was quite keen to join in. But I, you know, at the same time, he'd already started at another university. So if he didn't get in, he just carries on going to, and you know, it was a good university. I didn't really spend too much time speaking with anyone who applied in the same cohort as me and got rejected. I don't know. I don't think I knew the people who had been rejected well enough to for them to want to open up about it. And there was one other guy who had applied for psychology in my year. And so this was the first time, I don't know about ever, but definitely in a very long time, that anyone had applied for psychology from my school. Two of us applied.
Okay.
Again, you know, he wasn't in my class, but that was quite sad as well, because it would have been quite nice if there were a couple of us going along.
Yeah.
But yeah. I don't, did you have any close friends who got rejections?
I'm trying to think. I had one good friend who ended up getting an offer to study at Magdalen, but that was for natural sciences, which is great. Because I was, before we were kind of working out the chances of us both being able to go, okay. You know, even if you just assume roughly a 20% chance of getting in, well, it's one in 25, which is about a 4% chance, assuming you're both average applicants. So the fact that
it's low,
the fact that 4% came out, I mean, I don't think it was 4%, it's one reflection, but you know, that was obviously great. I did have one friend who I'd actually met at the summer school at Keys.
Okay.
In the year earlier. And he applied to my college. And I think he's probably one of the smartest guys I know. If you kind of ignore the Oxford dons in terms of our age group, he's probably very high, definitely top five. But he ended up getting pulled. He didn't get rejected.
Okay.
He got pulled. There is a happy story because the pool picked him up, I think.
Okay, so he did end up getting an offer.
He ended up, obviously, in the first week when I found out, he didn't. And obviously, that was pretty sad.
Yeah.
But thankfully, Gerton picked him up, and I think he had a great time there. So, it ended up working out very well in the end.
Yeah. So I guess neither of us really have too much. Well, we don't have the first-hand experience of having the rejection, nor do we have too much of the first-hand. Again, you know, I one of my friends did get rejected, but it was in a slightly different context.
I had friends who got rejected. They didn't apply to Oxbridge, but they got rejected from all medical schools.
Okay, yeah.
And I did have one friend who didn't even apply to, who was kind of considering like UCL, Imperial, but ended up applying to five other universities. He even wanted to do physics. And he got five offers, you know, so that was great. But at the end of it, he said, actually, I don't really want to go to any of these places. And I said, well, why didn't you apply to the others? Yeah, bright kid, got three A's. And I think he essentially shot himself in the foot because he was just so petrified of rejection.
Okay, yeah.
He put himself out there. Which, you know, it's not a rejection, but I think it almost is in many ways. It's like almost a fair victory at that point.
Yeah, I think that's I guess that's kind of the opposite of my approach. My approach was, why not? The worst that happens is they'll just say no. Mm. Whereas his approach was like that it genuinely was very bad for him if they do say no. And that's obviously, you know, it's a shame it's gone away. What did he do in the end? Did he reapply in the next year?
I think he just went to one of them in the end. Yeah. But that's a really interesting psychology, right? Because to think that a rejection can make such a difference, given that you only have to get into one.
Yeah.
Is all that matters. I mean, unless you're on a Two Blues podcast, no one's ever going to ask you applied 10 years ago.
Yeah, you know, obviously it's very different if you only get one application, but the fact that you've got four others that you can rely on, it's you know, worth taking a risk, I think. And I still carry that mentality whenever someone says to me, you know, I'm thinking about applying to Oxford or Cambridge, I say, well,
yeah, do it.
Why not? Like, what might take a bit more time, but realistically it's probably time well spent. You know, I think always go for it. It's sad when I speak to students who say that they've had teachers tell them not to. That irritates me. Again, I think partly because I semi had that.
But also, you know, the school's motivations are sometimes different, right? Because they've got to look at that. If, especially if it's a particularly good state or private or grammar school, they'll look at their percentage of success rather than the absolute number sometimes, which is obviously never good. Yeah. How did people's perception of you change after you got an offer, if at all?
I'm not sure I necessarily noticed an enormous change. I think my sort of my friendship group at school, I think, found it quite sort of entertaining. But I also think, you know, I like to think they were sort of proud and, you know, happy that sort of one of us had done it and managed it. But I don't think things changed. Again, I maybe I'm just quite oblivious to these things, but I don't think anything changed. Obviously, nowadays, when you say, you know, particularly doing my master's, one of the first things that a new person asks you is they say, you know, so what are you doing? Oh, I'm a master's student. Where did you do your undergrad? At Oxford. I think that definitely does make a difference. But I don't know if at the time we were that, you know, just sort of 17-year-old boys. I don't know if we were that bothered. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe everyone changed their minds about me completely. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, you went to a pretty good school where I think a fair amount went to Oxford.
Yeah, I mean, so our year did pretty badly. I remember being in assemblies and at the start of each year, and the headmaster would be like, he would say about the year above us that they'd broken records with their A-level scores or their exam scores and things like that. And the year below us, you know, they'd broken records with their GCSEs. This is when we were lower sixth. And that, you know, we'd also worked very hard. but yes, yeah, so I guess there was a history of people going to Oxford. It wasn't that new. I guess for you, it stood out more.
Yeah, I guess I was in a year of 750.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think about 15 of us, maybe 20, were going. So yeah, it wasn't insignificant in terms of numbers, but in a year that big, you obviously most of us didn't know each other. Like, I knew two or three people vaguely.
Yeah.
So that was, I think it probably did have an impact. And my friends were often like, just, you know, I think they were obviously pretty impressed. But I think it had a bigger impact on our family friends.
Okay.
Because for some reason, it just ended up working out that I was the first person in like our family circle that was going to Oxbridge.
Okay.
Whereas other people had applied, but just had been rejected for various reasons.
Sure.
So suddenly I had everyone kind of calling me saying congratulations, and which is obviously great.
Yeah.
But also, how should we, you know, we've got a 7-year-old daughter, what should she be doing to get into Oxford?
Okay. I wasn't solicited for advice, luckily.
Yeah, Rhea, if you're listening, now's the time to start preparing.
Yeah, interesting.
So I think people definitely started to look at me from people in like our parents' age with their friends started to look at me in a different way. But I think it was also they started to look at my parents in a different way. Just
okay.
So I think it was almost, it was obviously validation for me, as you know, and for you.
Yeah.
But it was also like a point of pride and validation from their
friends
as well. Because obviously, you know, when I made these sacrifices, they'd also had to make sacrifices as well. So they weren't able to go to me with the open days, but they were around to like shepherd me, buying me all sorts of various courses and books and things.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think it is a huge source of pride. Well, I think any achievements that a child achieves is obviously something which parents feel very proud of.
It's the first one, right? Like, I think if I had a sibling and they'd got in the second, it wouldn't probably be as, it'd be great, you know, it's still a great achievement. But the first time is always like special and important. Yeah. So the fact that it happened first time in like a fairly large circle of friends, I think made it much bigger.
Mm.
I think I was the only medic, and I think medicine was like held in this, you know, still obviously is held in this very high regard in my college in particular, because they had a poor record of medics. So I think all of that kind of contributed, which is, it was great. I really, I wouldn't say like, I think people's attitudes did change a little bit, in the sense that obviously they, they'd make jokes like, haha, you're so intelligent, you're going to kill cancer, yeah. Kind of like offhand comments like that. And obviously that's very far from like reality. Right. And initially I would like correct them. And after a point, I just got tired. I was like, yeah. I just went along
with it. Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned the siblings dynamic. I've forgotten about this, but my older brother had applied to Oxford and ended up going to Durham. But I don't think we ever really talked about it. I'm not sure, obviously that was a long time ago for him now, and he's doing very different stuff now. But I don't know if that... I don't know if he had sort of similarly to me had just been like, I'll give it a go, or if it was something that he'd really wanted. Maybe the fact that we didn't talk about it too much meant that it was something that was important. I don't know. But it is interesting, you see lots of families with siblings who apply. Sometimes you get multiple siblings who get in. I'd always thought that they would like, you'd expect Oxford or Cambridge to try and control against that really vigorously. But I knew so many friends who had an older brother or a younger sibling who had gone or were going to go to Oxford as well as them.
Yeah, I think and certain colleges have policies on this, and some of them are just kind of unwritten. So, for example, my college, for example, if my children, when they're old enough, apply to my college now, to Gonville and Caius, they have a policy where essentially, unless the policy changes, of course, in the next 20 years, their policy is they won't accept anyone in subsequent generations, but they will accept grandkids for some reason, which is an interesting way to do it. But it's not stated anywhere.
No.
So I know this because it's happened to someone I know. Okay. And they were told this exact thing.
Oh, really? They actually said explicitly it's because... Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Well, they claimed it. I mean, I wasn't there for the conversation. but it makes sense. But I didn't know that, and it's obviously not declared. So it just makes you wonder what other kind of rules are there around each of these colleges.
Yeah, I guess everyone, like, broadly speaking, people kind of know, don't apply to the same college as someone from your school. Try not to apply if there's some kind of connection, but I'd always assumed that was just sort of advice given just in case, rather than there's objectively things in that will get in the way here. Again, probably something which people should know about, because you wouldn't want that to get in the way of your application.
No, exactly. And if they do have this policy, they should kind of publicize it. In my year, there was actually one girl who was a medic, and her granddad went to our college. Okay. But I don't know anyone. Actually, I do know a very famous example. Carol Waterman.
Okay, from Canada.
Her child went to our college. But actually, thinking back to now, obviously, Carol Waterman probably didn't go to Caius. So I don't know what she did, but I'd be surprised if that was true.
Yeah. Caius is mixed now, right?
Caius is mixed, yeah.
Okay.
I think it's one of the later colleges to allow it, to accept it. So I guess people's perceptions obviously do change once you have
an
official and external validation. Like, that's just unavoidable, right? Like, it's whenever someone wins an award, like, they don't suddenly become a different person.
Yeah.
It's just their recognition has been, their achievement has been recognized.
Yeah.
In a public setting, which has the impact that more people take note, et cetera, et cetera.
And I think also, we're talking about parents, but for me as well, it was quite a big deal for my grandparents as well. So my granddad on my dad's side had been to UNIV, and sort of partly because they were doing this weird thing during the war that you would go for like a 1 year officer degree at Oxford, mm-hmm. And then get deployed, and then I think you go back and continue your degree afterwards. So you know, the fact that he had a grandchild who made it into Oxford was a big deal. But also on my mum's side, you know, I think my granddad on that side had passed away quite a few years earlier, but my grandmother was still alive, and I think that was, you know, it was quite a big deal. And again, it's, you know, pride, verification, like we said, of, you know, that performance, that talent, that kind of thing. It's not just, it doesn't just make you feel very happy that you've done well. There's a lot, the people around you get a lot of, you know, happiness out of it too, which is great, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, it's very much living vicariously through kids. But, you know, it's obviously, they've contributed to your, existence, but you're, you know, whatever the person you are at the age of 17, 18 is principally obviously genetics, but a lot of it is also the environmental factors of contributed. Yeah. So parents, close family, friends have all potentially had a big part in creating the person that ends up getting the offer. So they have a right to feel proud of indicating, right? As much.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. So yeah, obviously it's a very happy time. Sounds like it was, you know, less dramatic for you in the sense that you
didn't have, the cameras.
Yeah. I should probably try and dig that video out, actually.
So when it did come to results day, for you, when you woke up that morning, was it sort of like it was a done deal? You know, you're feeling pretty confident. You kind of knew that it was good news.
Yeah, I pretty much knew I'd got obviously, you know, you have to remember A-Stars didn't exist back then. Okay. So I think there just wasn't as much pressure. And I think I dropped like one mark in my physics in my AS. So I was pretty much starting off on almost a C, which I was pretty happy. I was like, right, if I don't get an A here, it's going to be something tragic must happen.
Yeah.
And obviously, once you've done a fair amount of papers and then you do the actual exam paper, and it pretty much fits in with the pattern and expectations of the past papers that you've done, it shouldn't come as much of a shock. There was one exam I was concerned about, which was, you'll find this funny, which was general studies. So we
didn't have that anymore. We didn't do that.
Well, I'm glad you didn't, because it was a very clever way for the college to get extra funding, because obviously the way they got money was the more A levels a student did, the more they got paid.
Okay.
I was quite keen on doing triple science and double maths.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were like, "Well, you're doing five. Why don't you do general studies as well?" I was like, "Okay, fine." And you know, we had like essentially like a weekly lesson on general studies, but it's a pretty broad topic to try and teach.
Yeah.
And the paper consisted of there were three exam papers. One was like scientific and maths, which was like dead easy. Did that in like half the time. And then one was like writing essays, which was okay. But then the essays were like fairly generic, but then there was another one on like humanities. And I was really, really worried about that one.
Okay.
So I can't remember what I got now. I think it was either an A or a B.
Made a difference, your score in general studies?
No, it wouldn't. But I think it was more of a pride thing for me.
Yeah.
So I was pretty confident that, you know, nothing's going to take away my Cambridge offer. I was a bit of a nerd and did these other exams called Advanced Extension Awards.
So okay.
Called AEAs. I don't know if you've heard of them.
No.
If you remember when you did like Key Stage 2 SATs, do you ever do them?
Nope.
No? Okay.
I think things have changed.
No, SATs still exist.
I never sat SATs. I don't know who does. I thought they were an American thing. No?
No, not. Well, okay. So in year six, you sit like these tests, and then some schools, you sit them again in year nine.
Okay.
And like they're the standardized testing, except you do them in biology, chemistry, science, English, and maths.
Okay.
And they're like levels associated. So you can do a similar thing for A-levels as well, where you can obviously do your A-level paper, and then there's these extension awards, which essentially test like the top segment of students.
Okay.
So it's like further maths, except it's more, you don't need to study extra work for it. You just have to apply your material. It's a bit sure. like the BMAT, right? Like, but just yeah. a level standard or like the Olympiad level. So I was a bit of a masochist to myself and kind of did all four of them. So I did biology, chemistry, maths, and physics.
Okay.
And they were brutal papers, 3 hours each. And annoyingly, which I didn't know when I chose to do them, they took place at the end of exam term.
Right.
So I'd finished all my exams and then I had another four of these.
Everyone else was out celebrating.
Everyone was out and I had these bad boys lined up.
Yeah.
Those are the ones I was worried about passing. Okay. And in fairness, I didn't pass all of them. So, but okay. yeah. It made zero difference. So,
yeah. Is the thinking behind it that it's just good to have the extra qualification, or does it contribute to anything?
I mean, I've got them, but I don't think anyone's ever asked me, and I don't think it's ever made a difference. Again, I think it was just like if you're driven by challenge, this was like, okay, how do you make A levels more interesting or challenging? Yeah. This is like. In fairness, I learned a fair amount from it. And, you know, it was nice to have the confidence of passing a few, but
yeah,
it made no difference to anything long term.
Okay.
So those were the only tests I was like,
worrying
about. Lying as to whether it passed. I see worry is like a strong worry is probably the wrong word. Just thought that may fail. Like the others, I was like, okay. I mean, even if I failed all four of them, it wouldn't have mattered.
Yeah. So I get for me, so on results day, I checked my UCAS before I found out my grades.
Mm.
So I checked my UCAS to see if Oxford had confirmed it.
Yeah, I
did, because again, I think by that point, I think the pressure had built, right? Because you know how anticlimactic if after all this. I've ended up screwing up, and because I'd done history,
being there as well on that day.
Well, yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. But yeah, because I'd done history, which is essay based, very subjective, difficult. You know, you come out of exams feeling like you've done a good job, but again, difficult to know if you've got it right. And I did psychology, which again was very heavily essay based. So I guess I had a couple points where I didn't know as much. The maths, by that point, I'd sorted out my maths and I was pretty confident on the maths side. But there was still this worry that, it would let me down. But so I saw that I'd got the offer. So I knew, okay, it's fine. You've got at least an A star and two A's. That's fine. And then, went into school, found the results. I did have, this is probably something that we can talk about another time, but I did have a friend who didn't get any of his offers and had to go through clearing.
Mm.
And that was quite tough for him. He sort of had to spend that day, that afternoon, sort of sat down at a table somewhere with his parents calling places. So I think that's another, obviously we talked about a bit about the Oxbridge rejection, but the overall UCAS rejection, I think is a very stressful process. I've had, lots of people, a number of people close to me have to go through that. So I think that's another thing which is very difficult, and thankful that I didn't have to. But the actual results day was a big relief. We went out celebrating. I hadn't decided. Oh no! By that point, your other exams were over, so that's fine.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, obviously, very very happy memories for both of us.
Yeah.
So probably start wrapping up. Anything else to say on this?
No, I think that's probably it. I think we covered it.
I'm excited to hear your fact for the week.
Yeah. So my fact is that nutmeg is a hallucinogenic drug.
Oh.
And basically, you need to have at least 2 teaspoons of nutmeg in order to get the hallucinogenic effects. And, sort of common... symptoms when you've had all this nutmeg. I don't know why you'd have that much nutmeg, obviously to hallucinate, but sort of hallucinations, palpitations, and also interestingly, feelings of impending doom. So those are the kind of, if that's what you want of an evening, get out the nutmeg jar, and 2 teaspoons is not a huge amount of nutmeg. You get through that pretty quickly. But interestingly, according to his son, Nostradamus made all his predictions high on nutmeg. And okay. that kind of explains that the feelings of impending doom explains yeah. why most of the things he's talking about is sort of wars and destruction and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So, you know, you can see where that's come from now.
Okay. What were the other symptoms? So hallucinogen, feeling of impending doom.
Palpitations, nausea, sort of things like that.
It sounds very cardiac to me. As a doctor, it sounds like it must affect the heart quite a lot, because if you think of palpitations, feeling of impending doom, yeah. nausea,
yeah.
maybe sweating, those are all found in myocardial events. Like essentially a heart attack is associated with all of those.
So the compound, the hallucinogenic compounds, I don't know if this will ring any bells for you, there are two, one called myristicin, and one called safrole. Does that?
No, it doesn't. But I mean, it sounds very. I'd be astonished if they didn't have any impact on the heart based on the symptoms you've said.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And also, so they say allegedly there have been two cases of people overdosing and dying off of nutmeg.
Okay.
So you know, on the scale of dangerous drugs, it's actually a bit of a dangerous one, because you know. Allegedly as well, things like marijuana, no one has ever died off of overdosing, whereas they have off of nutmeg.
Right. If you were reforming the drug rules in the UK. Yeah.
Nutmeg straight up to class A.
Not allowed to deal.
Yeah. Sorry to anyone who was using it in their cooking, but Tesco not anymore.
And Asda would go under.
Yeah. The black market nutmeg. County lines dealers would start up.
Well, my fact kind of actually relates completely unplanned, actually, in this case, is actually a cardiac fact, which is when I was a junior doctor, I was asked to come see a patient who had an abnormal heart rhythm. So they were having palpitations. And often what can happen is sometimes when someone's heart's going so fast, is the machines that we use won't be able to discern what is abnormal about it. I mean, you can tell it's abnormal,
right?
But it doesn't fit into like three or four typical abnormal heart rhythms that we see. So in order to essentially see what the abnormality is, you can probably see where I'm going with this, is you have to slow the heart down. But okay. Sometimes even slowing the heart down can be quite dangerous, right? Like if you do it very quickly, because half-lives of drugs, etc., they're very depend on the person, etc. So instead, we use this drug called adenosine. Okay. And adenosine is injected in the arm, and it has a half-life of a few seconds. And what it does is it blocks all the receptors in the heart, which are responsible for kind of the pacemaking activity. And essentially, it'll stop the heart. But it'll only stop it for a few seconds.
Oh, that's fine then.
So the first time I had to use adenosine, it's obviously a very scary experience, right? So I kind of insist on having a anaesthetist with me. It was way overkill.
Yeah.
But you know, I was a junior doctor, so I thought better to be safe.
Yeah.
So you inject this drug and you actually see like this, you keep running the rhythm strip, this ECG machine constantly going on, like you see in hospitals, mm-hmm. except they've got like 12 wires attached to them. And you see this kind of rhythm slow down, and then their heart stop, and they flatline for a bit. And then you count 1, 2, 3, and then suddenly, they
come back.
But those 3 seconds, I still remember as probably being one of the longest 3 seconds of my life.
Yeah, I bet.
I'm like, God, if he doesn't wake up, I'll actually kill him.
I mean, have I killed this man?
I mean, they always wake up, right? Because it's, as I said, the half-life's like a few seconds.
Do they always wake up?
Well, everyone I've given it to. but yeah. So, and obviously, you know, it worked well. We were able to identify the rhythm mm-hmm. and kind of cardiovert and bring it back to normality. But I just think that's a fascinating thing, that most of the drugs we give in medicine are pretty much, they'll last for hours, if not days.
Yeah.
But this is an instance of a few seconds where it'll last.
Yeah.
Which I don't think there are many drugs like that.
No, and I guess also its use is very specific, right? Because most of the time you want a drug to last, But I suppose a heart-stopping drug that lasts is a bad idea. Well,
cool. Well, good speaking with you as always.
Yeah, likewise. I'll see you in the next one.
That's good. Take care.
See ya.